content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated August 26, 2024. As usual, the front cover is bordered in bright red with a narrow white inner border. Time is, in this edition, in white, large block print, capital lettering, superimposed upon a pale background, which is neither gray nor beige, but perhaps a very pale stone color. The cover image is that of a woman. It looks like it's either illustrated or perhaps it's photoshopped. I'm looking for its credit, but I'm not finding any credit for it. It is basically in black and white, although there are gradations of color in it. It is of Kamala Harris. The caption reads, "Her Moment," and Charlotte Alter's follow-up article will follow shortly. Kamala Harris has long, dark hair, slightly streaked in lighter tones. Perhaps it's highlighted, or perhaps we're seeing just strands of gray. She has very dark eyes. As I said, this is a primarily black and white, either drawing or altered photograph of her. So the skin tone is not pale, nor is it dark. It's a medium in between. Her lips are closed, but she appears to be smiling at the camera. She's wearing small pearl earrings, and that's really all we see, except perhaps a white scarf or a white collar around her neck. The first article is entitled, "Bangladesh on Edge After Coup." It is within the Bulletin column. It is written by Charlie Campbell. There's a photo that takes approximately half the page. It appears to be a government building, perhaps even a temple. It's in white with gilt trim. Columns at the portico. People crowded in front of it, as well as on the rooftop. People showing flags of dark green background with bright red-orange balls or spheres centered upon that background. The caption reads, "Anti-government protesters storm the Prime Minister's palace in Dhaka, August 5. Sheikh Hasina Wazed was proud of her house." When the Bangladeshi Prime Minister welcomed Time to her Ghanababan official residence in Dhaka last fall, she spent half an hour giving a personal tour of the manicured grounds stippled with pomelo trees and swing sets for her grandchildren. But August 5, with furious protesters closing in, Hasina was forced to flee her palatial home in a helicopter. Jubilant crowds clambered onto the Ghanababan's roof and carried away spoils, including furniture, pets, and Hasina's own silk saris. In a televised address, the Army Chief, General Waqar-uz-Zaman, confirmed that Hasina, 76, had resigned and that he would form an interim government. "I am taking full responsibility," he said. What was effectively a coup d'etat has been driven by a popular uprising that metastasized from initially peaceful demonstrations against employment quotas for descendants of freedom fighters in Bangladesh's 1971 War of Independence. Against a backdrop of rising joblessness, the quotas were seen as nepotistic rewards for regime loyalists. Instead of talks, Hasina dispatched the Chhatra League, the thuggish student wing of her ruling Awami League party, to confront the demonstrators, with subsequent clashes and a brutal crackdown by security forces, officially claiming more than 300 lives, including at least 32 children. Despite its historical preference for playing its own hand in politics, Bangladesh's military had backed Hasina, even in the face of her increasingly autocratic tendencies. Yet April 4, Zaman tellingly declared, "The armed forces always stood by the people." Nobel laureate Muhammad Yunus, who pioneered poverty-reducing microcredit, has been tapped to shepherd the nation of 170 million toward fresh elections. "The country has suffered a lot," Zaman said. "The economy has been hit. Many people have been killed. It is time to stop the violence." Sadly, unrest continued following Hasina's departure, with Awami League buildings ransacked and the nation's Hindu minority also targeted. Hasina, who won a fourth straight term in January elections boycotted by the main opposition party, had ruled the South Asian nation for 20 of the past 28 years. But by co-opting all the organs of the state, Bangladesh's Iron Lady entrenched public distrust of the police, military, courts, and civil service. Repairing the integrity of institutions while keeping a lid on radical Islamists will be key to restoring democracy. "Bangladesh is a key player in the global economy," says Michael Kugelman, director of the South Asia Institute at the Wilson Center. "There's going to be concern about the prospect of extended unrest." Turning the page to the brief milestones, the first is an almost full-page article. Released, prisoners of Putin, Evan Gershkovich and 15 others finally free. This is written by Nick Popley. Though President Joe Biden did the honors when it came time to announce the news, the historic August 1 swap that resulted in the release of more than 20 Russian-held prisoners, including Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich and two other American citizens, relied on the cooperation of seven countries. At a time of deepening global tensions, the rare moment of collaboration was not just a cause for celebration among the prisoners and their families, but also a significant diplomatic achievement. For Biden, who's long pledged both to secure the release of imprisoned Americans and to support pro-democracy movements abroad, the sweeping exchange was a meaningful victory at a moment when, amid the drama of the presidential election, his capacity to lead had been cast into doubt. Standing alongside the families of the released prisoners, he acknowledged the critical role played by allied nations, framing the win as proof the U.S. can still lead in the realm of international cooperation. "For anyone who questions whether allies matter, they do," Biden said. "Today is a powerful example of why it is vital to have friends in this world, friends you can trust, work with, and depend on, especially on matters of great consequence and sensitivity like this. Our alliances make our people safer. Of course, for the former prisoners and their families, diplomatic concerns came second. First were hugs and tears, captured by cameras as Gershkovitz, former U.S. Marine Paul Whelan, and Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty journalist Alsu Kormosheva arrived at Joint Base Andrews just before midnight. Gershkovitz, 32, spent 16 months in a Russian prison after being accused of gathering information for the CIA while on assignment in Yekaterinburg. The claims were dismissed by the U.S. government as baseless and his trial widely criticized as a sham. Whelan, 54, was arrested in December 2018 while on a trip to Moscow and convicted on charges of espionage, a verdict international observers called politically motivated. He was sentenced to 16 years in a Russian penal colony after a closed-door trial. Kormosheva, 47, was arrested in 2023 during a visit to Russia to care for her ailing mother on charges of failing to register her American passport. She was later charged with spreading false information about Russia's military, a charge linked to her work as a journalist and a book she helped edit that criticized the invasion of Ukraine. She was sentenced to 6.5 years in prison after a secret trial. Asked what he would say to former President Donald Trump, who claimed he would have gotten the American prisoners released without giving anything in return, Biden said, "Why didn't he do it as president?" In the end, the deal saw the release of Vadim Krasikov, a convicted Russian hitman who had been serving a life sentence in Germany, as well as three Russians held by the U.S., convicted hackers Vladislav Klyushin and Roman Seleznyov, and Vadim Konoshenok, who was facing charges of conspiracy. The 16 people released from Russia included five Germans and seven Russian citizens who were political prisoners. It also says a lot about us that this deal includes the release of Russian political prisoners, Biden said. They stood up for democracy and human rights. Their own leaders threw them in prison. The United States helped secure their release as well. That is who we are. In the United States, we stand for freedom, for liberty, for justice, not only for our own people, but for others as well. That is why all Americans can take pride in what we have achieved today. There is a list here of individuals released by Russia. Looks like 16. I'll read just the names. Evan Gershkovitz, Alsu Kormosheva, Ilya Yashin, Rico Krieger, Dieter Voronin, Patrick Schöbel, Ksenia Fadayeva, Vadim Ostanin, Paul Whelan, Vladimir Karamurza, Oleg Orlov, Kevin Leek, German Moises, Alexandra Skolchenko, Lilia Chanasheva, Andrei Pipovarov. Moving to the next article in the brief milestones, disputed victory for Gonzalez. Venezuela's Defiant Opposition by Alex Gonzalez Omerod, who is founder of the Mexico Political Economist. The day after Venezuela's July 28 presidential election, the National Electoral Council said it could not provide the world with actual results of the vote. Yet somehow it irrevocably declared the autocratic Nicolas Maduro as the winner. over opposition candidate Edmundo González Urrutia. The opposition was ready. It had gathered 73.2% of the receipts printed by Venezuela's electronic voting machines and published them on a website launched a day after the vote. By its calculations, González won with a two-thirds majority. Venezuela's democracy has long been in crisis. What began as a popular movement under socialist President Hugo Chavez in 1999 gradually slid into autocracy. His expropriation schemes and a 2014 oil price slump all but destroyed the petrostate's economy. And Maduro, who took office in 2013, shifted from redistribution to repression. The opposition was under no illusion that this election would be free or fair. It ran a campaign that expressed trust that the ballot box would vindicate it while planning for the worst. Maduro's government has doubled down on the baseless claim that Venezuelan democracy is under siege by foreign interventionists and has cracked down on protest. But the opposition's plan is producing results. The U.S. has come out in support of González, and the EU does not recognize Maduro's win. Even friendly Latin American governments are pressuring him to set the record straight. Venezuela has powerful allies, but Maduro is increasingly alone. The upshot in Venezuela remains uncertain, but the crucial days that followed the election were a long time in the making. And finally, in the milestones column, the short column of five more items. Canceled, three Taylor Swift concerts in Vienna after a foiled terrorism threat. Announced August 7, for which two people were arrested. Named October 7, terrorist attack architect Yahya Sinwar as political leader of the Hamas. The Palestinian militant group announced August 6, 6 days after the assassination of its previous leader in Iran. Ruled that Google, with its search engine, is a monopoly that has acted illegally to maintain that status. U.S. District Judge Amit Mehta ruled August 5, concluding a mammoth antitrust case brought by the Justice Department. Google has said it will appeal. Dismantled many of the thousands of sidewalk dining sheds in New York City that proliferated during COVID-19 lockdown ahead of an August 3 deadline to either meet specific regulations or tear the structures down. And finally developed a cool paint for cars, Nissan announced August 6. It claims the thick paint lowers vehicle interior temperatures by 9 degrees Fahrenheit in tests. The brief news, good question. As the personal check disappears, what comes next? By Alana Samuels. One of the first checks ever recorded was written in the 11th century in a marketplace in Basra in what is today Iraq. There, a merchant issued a sock, S-A-K-K, written instructions to his bank to make a payment from his account. 1,000 years later, this form of payment is finally disappearing. Target, in July, became the latest retailer to stop accepting checks. It is just the latest sign that the check is nearing obsolescence. The average American writes just one check a month, down from 3 in 2016, according to a Federal Reserve survey. In 1995, the year of peak usage, Americans wrote 49.5 billion checks, which was 15 checks each month by every man, woman, and child in the U.S. I absolutely think we are moving to a world of check zero, says Scott Anchin, Vice President of the Independent Community Bankers of America. From a security perspective, this is a positive. Checks are not a particularly safe way to send money. They have your account and routing numbers on them, sensitive information criminals could use. They can be stolen in the mail and changed to be made out to different people or for different amounts. Flawed as checks are, though, they have not gone away entirely because many people still depend on them, especially to pay rent and utility bills. But experts say a new kind of payment may finally change that. The newest type of payment, the first to be introduced in the U.S. since the 1970s, is called instant payments, in which money moves from your account to another immediately. You may think you already use instant payments with services like Venmo, but you don't. Those payments come from a Venmo account rather than directly from your bank account, and the funds can take some time to move. Here's how instant payments work. Different types of payments, wire transfers, checks, ACH, all happen over what are called rails. A rail is essentially the system that gets your money from one place to another. Think of a pile of cash in a briefcase. You can move that briefcase from one place to another in a car or a bus or a train or an airplane. Those transportation methods are like the rails that move your money. Instant payments are a new kind of payment rail, but there still needs to be a user interface to allow consumers to access them. Some payments on Zelle already happen on an instant payment rail, says Bridget Hall of ACI Worldwide, which builds software for financial institutions and large enterprises. 1 year ago, the Federal Reserve launched FedNow, an instant payment rail that allows for people to send money to one another if they are enrolled in participating institutions. Another payment rail, RTP, short for real-time payments, was launched in 2017 by the Clearing House, a private payment system infrastructure. Instant payments are different from anything that exists now, including wire transfers, ACH payments, essentially electronic bank transfers, and debit cards, because they happen in real time, at any hour of any day, and do not cost anything. Yet they accounted for just 1.5% of total payments in 2023. About 3.5 billion transactions, according to ACI Worldwide. Experts expect that number to grow to 14 billion real-time transactions by 2028. Instant payments are already very popular in other parts of the world. In India, real-time payments were launched in 2010. And now make up 84% of the share of all electronic payments. But the two rails for instant payments in the U.S., FedNow and RTP, are relatively new. It has taken this long for the U.S. to adopt real-time payments because there were intermediaries like PayPal that allowed people to feel like they were paying someone else instantly, says Hall. There are some big advantages to instant payments. Say you have to fund a lunch account at your kid's school. A credit card may involve a transaction fee, while a check takes days to be processed. The velocity of instant payments is a good thing for businesses, too. Instead of waiting for a check to arrive and then discovering there's no money in the user's account, an electricity company, can get paid instantly. If we start looking at the payment methods used to complete a transaction today, Hall says, we have many use cases where the options either are not great or are not good enough. Moving now to the cover article. A full two-page of photos accompanies this article. Lots of bunting here, lots of flags, red, white, and blue all over, white stars on blue bunting, red and white and blue flags, and on the stage, which is carpeted in blue. Well, they don't have a caption, but I can tell you who they are. I can tell you the photograph is by Brendan Smilovsky, and I can tell you that the title of the article is Second Chance, and the caption reads, the New Democratic Ticket rallies in Philadelphia August 6, and another caption reads, the reintroduction of Kamala Harris by Charlotte Alter, Philadelphia, and here on the stage, waving, smiling, and clapping along with much of the crowd, stand Kamala Harris dressed in a blue pantsuit, dark blue that is, and a creamy white blouse beneath, same long dark hair, bright smile in this photo, and next to her, in either a dark blue or a black suit with a white shirt and a dark blue tie, Tim Walz, the VP candidate, alongside the presidential candidate of the Democrats. Crowds in the background. They're obviously facing cameras, but this may be a room in the round with a crowd in the round. At obviously specific intervals, just below the stage, standing are what appear to be a bunch of Secret Service personnel, dressed in dark suits, white shirts, and blue ties, and no ties for the women. Turning the page now to the article, which may be a bridge. It's a bit lengthy. The soundtrack suggested a Beyoncé concert. The light-up bracelets evoked the Eras tour, and the exuberant crowd, more than 14,000 strong, lining up in the rain, resembled the early days of Barack Obama. Inside a Philadelphia arena, August 6, Vice President Kamala Harris was greeted with a kind of reception a Democratic presidential candidate has not gotten in years. Fans packed into overflow spaces, waving homemade signs made of glitter and glue, as drum lines roared. When Harris introduced her new running mate, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, the cheering lasted more than a minute. If you had predicted this scene a month ago to anyone following the race, they would never have believed you. But Harris has pulled off the swiftest vibe shift in modern political history, a contest that revolved around the cognitive decline of a geriatric president has been transformed. Joe Biden is out, Harris is in, and a second Donald Trump presidency no longer seems inevitable. Democrats resigned to a grim death march toward certain defeat, as one national organizer put it, felt their gloom replaced by a jolt of hope. Harris smashed fundraising records, raking in $310 million in July. She packed stadiums and dominated TikTok, offering a fresh message focused on the future over the past. Volunteers signed up in droves. Trump's widening leads across the battleground states evaporated. Over the span of a few weeks in late July and early August, Harris became a political phenomenon. Our campaign is not just a fight against Donald Trump, she told the cheering crowd in Philadelphia. Our campaign is a fight for the future. Where has this Kamala Harris been all along? For years, Democratic officials questioned her political chops, pundits mocked her word salads, and her polling suggested limited appeal. Her performance in the 2020 presidential primary was wooden, and her turn as Biden's number two did little to inspire confidence. Even this summer, as party insiders chattered about possible replacements if Biden stepped aside, it was explicit from some of the major donors she cannot win, says Amanda Littman, co-founder of Run for Something, an organization that trains young Democrats to run for office. They did not think people were ready to elect someone like her. Judging from the past few weeks, Harris's own party underestimated her. Maybe the crowded 2020 primary just was not the right race for Harris to show her talents. Maybe the vice presidency was not the right role. Suddenly, she seems matched to the moment, a former prosecutor running against a convicted felon, a defender of abortion rights running against the man who helped overturn Roe v. Wade, a next-generation Democrat running against a 78-year-old Republican. Perhaps above all, she's given Americans the one thing they overwhelmingly told pollsters they wanted, a credible alternative to two unpopular old men who've held the job for the past 8 long years. Harris may still be the underdog. Trump has arguably the clearer path to 270 electoral votes and an edge on the issues that voters say are most important to them. Harris will have to answer for the Biden administration's record, including on inflation and border security. Republicans are casting her as a coastal elite, pointing to positions she took in the 2020 primary, arguing for gun buybacks, a ban on fracking, an overhaul of the health insurance system that may indeed be too liberal to win over many of the swing voters who decide elections. Harris has yet to do a single substantive interview or to explain her policy shifts. Her campaign denied a request for an interview for this story. She has to repair ruptures in the party coalition, galvanizing the Black, Hispanic, Arab American, and young voters who migrated away from Biden. Though her early polling numbers are far better than Biden's were, she lags his 2020 support with some key demographic groups she needs to win. Harris has less than 90 days to prove she can convert the momentum of her successful launch into a tough, smart operation capable of beating a former president with a dedicated base of support and a knack for commanding the stage. She inherited a campaign infrastructure and policy record from her predecessor, but the energy is all hers. Picking balls as a running mate over more conventional choices signals a belief that this race is as much about feelings as it is about fundamentals. Harris's brand shift, the happy warrior attitude, the viral memes, the eye roll at Republican weirdos, has already done what no Trump opponent has ever been able to do, snatch the spotlight away from him. During Harris's travels, the team assembled a spreadsheet of allies, power brokers, potential delegates to tap if and when the time came. Every photo line, every VIP invitation, every clutch with labor leaders, every meeting with key constituencies was filed away. The goal, advisors say, was to ensure there would be allies on every delegate slate in every state in the nation. We had a list, says one top aide, and we checked it twice. The list was intended for 2028. But when Biden dropped out July 21 and quickly endorsed Harris, it was instantly pressed into service. The vice president, clad in a Howard University sweatshirt, munching pizza with anchovies, spent the next 10 hours on the phone. dialing delegates and wrangling endorsements. A day later, the nomination was all but hers. Even though other presidential hopefuls had ties to swing states or big donors, the list was the thing that we had that they didn't, says a top aide. It was not a fairy godmother waving a magic wand. Harris's ability to sew up the nomination so quickly was a triumph of work ethic and political dexterity that foreshadowed what was to come. To consolidate the Democratic Party in a matter of hours, to do as many visible events and establish that presence without putting a foot wrong is a feat, says Pete Buttigieg, Transportation Secretary, who ran against Harris for the 2020 nomination and was a finalist to become her running mate. I don't think anybody expected her to be so flawless. With Biden no longer atop the ticket, the moribund Democratic grassroots came to life. Harris was capable of delivering a message that never felt quite right under Clinton or Biden, that theirs was the party of the future and Trump was of the past. Her campaign raised $200 million in the first week, in what it said was the best 24 hours of any candidate in presidential campaign history. More than 38,000 people registered on vote.org in the 48 hours after she became the presumptive nominee, eclipsing the voter registration surge encouraged by Taylor Swift last year. Within a week, Harris erased Trump's polling dominance in key states, turning a burgeoning landslide into a dead heat. Even if Washington was taken by surprise, the energetic fighter of the past 2 weeks matches the Harris whom allies say they have known for years. Louise Wren, a former San Francisco city attorney, recalls that when Harris took over the city's interest in adoption cases in the DA's office, she brought an armful of teddy bears to court her first day. Andrea Du Steele, a donor advisor who snacked on wine and cheese with Harris as they typed up her first political bio sheet for her 2003 campaign for San Francisco DA, remembers Harris sitting outside grocery stores with an ironing board stacked with campaign literature. Those who made it through her 2020 primary recall that after she dropped out, she joined the last of her staff in a dance party in the campaign headquarters. One challenge for Harris has been the people around her. Over the years, a rotating cast of senior staff has clouded her message and raised questions about her ability as a manager. She needs a few political conciliaires in her life. She does not have a North Star guiding her, says one Democratic strategist. She's made novice political moves that the political elite and the pundits have glommed onto that have pushed the narrative that she's not ready for prime time. That narrative has been out of date for some time, according to allies who've worked with her and watched her closely. To the extent anyone was paying attention, they saw this negative stuff amplified and dialed up by the right. Then there stopped being coverage of her, says a close advisor. The caricature of Harris, the advisor says, became frozen in time. Meanwhile, the VP continued her work, leading on a bunch of important issues, but people weren't really tracking that. Longtime allies argue many of her Senate priorities on criminal justice reform, racial equity, maternal health became administration priorities. Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey, another former 2020 presidential rival, says that over the past 3 years, Harris has mastered the art of arm twisting required to pass major legislation and become a global diplomat championing Democratic goals. She has gone, Booker says, from being a Padawan to a Jedi master. Yet if Harris was widely underestimated, it is also true her circumstances have radically changed. Success in politics is situational. Harris no longer has to compete with more than 20 other Democrats for attention on the campaign trail, or contort herself to appease liberal pieties to win over the party's base. She no longer has to be a loyal deputy to the president who calls all the shots. Now the moment is finally hers. That lengthy article was slightly abridged. It was written by Charlotte Alter, Philadelphia, with reporting by Leslie Dickstein and Julia Zorthian, New York, and Brian Bennett, Philip Elliott, and Nick Popley, Washington. The Brief, Ungreat Britain, by Armani Syed, London. How online misinformation stoked anti-immigrant riots. How it stoked anti-immigrant riots across the UK. I apologize, that was small print for a headline caption. Online misinformation about a triple murder sparked Britain's worst riots in 13 years, and an international debate about the failure of social media platforms to police hate speech and false reports. The attacks targeted immigrants and broke out in predominantly English towns and cities, as well as Northern Ireland. Far-right groups were recorded looting, attacking police and locals, and performing Nazi salutes. Mobs chanting, "Send them home," and "Islam out," destroyed mosques and graffitied racial slurs on homes. In some of the more violent instances, rioters stormed hotels housing asylum seekers. In one case, a fire was set while guests and staff were inside. Prime Minister Keir Starmer condemned the violence as far-right thuggery and later called on large social media companies to police hate that is whipped up online. Following an emergency Downing Street meeting August 5, Starmer pledged a standing army of 6,000 specialist officers to tackle violent outbreaks. Hundreds of arrests were made in connection with the attacks, including for stirring racial hatred online. The uprisings were organized on social media following the spread of misinformation that the fatal stabbing of three young girls at a dance class in Southport, a town in northwest England, was carried out by a Muslim immigrant. The violence first erupted July 30 near the scene of the stabbing, with hundreds of masked people gathering to throw bricks and rocks at a Southport mosque. After pressure from mainstream media, a judge waived an anonymity rule for minors August 1 to reveal the suspect, Axel Radu Cubana, 17, was born in Cardiff, Wales, and is not Muslim. The online campaign of false information continued, however. Incendiary posts were shared across Facebook and Telegram, and lists of targets forwarded on WhatsApp. One post claiming that an asylum seeker or migrant was responsible for the Southport stabbing reached at least 15.7 million accounts across various platforms, according to Reuters. In the days that followed, the online efforts spread violence to other towns and cities across the UK, including Liverpool, Belfast, Manchester, and smaller urban areas in the north and south of the country. Social media has become an essential tool for extremist groups to galvanize a spark to flash, says Jacob Davy, Director of Policy and Research for Counter Hate at the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. Davy says social media treats a permissive environment that enables violent or radical individuals to engage in herd mentality. We would not see the types of activity we saw over the weekend without it, he told Time, August 5. Isolated incidents, he says, are platformed by high-profile, deeply cynical actors who encourage their followers to commit acts of violence. Davy says content recommendation systems and algorithms can amplify disinformation to a boiling point. The UK introduced protections under the Online Safety Act of 2023, which places certain responsibilities on social media companies to ensure user safety on their platforms. But X, formerly Twitter owner Elon Musk, instead framed the crisis to his 193 million followers as a test of free speech. The billionaire engaged in a war of words with Starmer over the protests, the role social media has played in them, and the Prime Minister's crackdown on those involved with the riots, bringing into high relief the global tension between elected governments and the supranational, immensely wealthy, and privately controlled platforms that control communications. August 3, Musk, a free speech absolutist, performed the online equivalent of shouting fire in a crowded theater, writing, "Civil war is inevitable," under footage of a chaotic street scene someone had labeled the effect of mass migration and open borders. The unrest has brought renewed attention to anxieties about UK migration. Stopping small boats of migrants crossing the English Channel to enter Britain was a policy priority for both the Labour Party and the Conservative Party during July's election. Donna Jones, a Conservative politician and local police and crime commissioner for Hampshire and the Isle of Wight, suggested that current unrest is an act of rebellion against mass, uncontrolled immigration. Other politicians drew a distinction between concerns about immigration and the legitimization of what some have branded thuggery. But rising fears about migration are concentrated in small communities, says Anand Menon, director of the UK in a Changing Europe think tank. If you look at the British people as a whole, what you are talking about is a low level of concern about immigration, and actually a far more positive view of immigration overall than was the case in 2016, when 52% of the nation voted to leave the EU, says Menon. A February Ipsos poll on Brits' attitudes toward immigration found positive views had dipped since July 2022, but remain overall more positive than negative. In a survey of 3,000 adults, 40% believe migration has had a positive impact on the nation, while 35% held a negative view. August 7, when more than 100 far-right gatherings were expected, thousands of peaceful, anti-racist counter-protesters took to the streets in their local communities. While the anticipated disorder did not emerge, Starmer struck a note of caution the following morning. "It is important that we do not let up," he said. "We need to make sure that in the coming days we can give the necessary reassurance to our communities, many of whom are very anxious about the situation." The View, History, Watergate's Real Legacy. This is by Bruce J. Shulman, who's a professor at Boston University and author of The 70s. This may be a bridge. We'll see. When Richard Nixon resigned 50 years ago this August, he became the first and so far only U.S. president driven from the nation's highest office. His departure was the result of the political establishment coming together in the wake of Watergate. The experience, Nixon's successor asserted, had vindicated American democracy. Our Constitution works, President Gerald Ford declared. In the early 1970s, it seemed as if the nation's leadership, Republicans and Democrats alike, had closed ranks to preserve widely held norms. Half a century later, the lessons of Watergate look very different. Instead of constraining the executive branch, Nixon's ouster marked the beginning of a long-term effort to strengthen the presidency, which culminated with the July 1 presidential immunity ruling from the Supreme Court. Today's Americans live not in the reassuring afterglow of Watergate, but in its long, destabilizing shadow. After Nixon's resignation, Congress reformed the campaign finance system and passed an Ethics in Government Act that included a mechanism for independent counsel investigations of executive branch scandals. And after the Supreme Court ruled in U.S. v. Nixon that the president must comply with subpoenas, the Presidential Records Act of 1978 made clear the papers of the president and vice president belong to the public. Watergate produced a broad consensus to rein in the imperial presidency. Congress established intelligence oversight committees with access to classified materials. It also produced unprecedented respect for the press, which had played a key role in exposing the scandal. In 1974, trust in the media hit a high at 72%. A new generation of reformers were inspired to run for office. In the 1974 midterms, Democrats won congressional majorities. These Watergate babies undid the seniority system in Congress and brought into the open previously backroom decision-making. They even brought TV cameras into the House of Representatives. In the first post-Watergate presidential contest, Democrat Jimmy Carter found success by campaigning on a fairly credible claim that he would not lie to the American people. "What the voters are looking for," he said, "is someone who can run the government competently, who understands their problems, and will tell the truth." And yet today the political landscape could hardly be more different. What happened? Wiping out mainstream Republicans like Nixon and Ford, Watergate cleared the way for the takeover of the GOP by Sunbelt conservatives, while stoking the distrust in government that fueled the Reagan Revolution. On the other side of the aisle, the Watergate babies, younger, more suburban, launched the transition of the Democratic Party from the voice of blue-collar workers into today's more affluent, educated bloc. Ethics rules became tools for forcing out rivals. For example, in 1988, ambitious young Republican Congressman Newt Gingrich filed ethics charges against Democratic House Speaker Jim Wright, ousting him the next year. Before Watergate, federal indictments of public officials were almost unheard of. In the following two decades, there were over 8,000. Meanwhile, the press became more adversarial and partisan. By 2016, only 32% of Americans reported at least a fair amount of trust in the media. Congress became more transparent but less effective. In the House, the Watergate babies forced out long-serving committee chairs, diluting leadership's control over the agenda. The Senate lowered the bar for ending filibusters and empowered junior members. Cable TV gave members of Congress easy access to media. On both sides of the Hill, leadership lost power to discipline members and force through legislation. Today, rank-and-file legislators like Marjorie Taylor Greene can become celebrities and pressure their parties on fringe issues, while Congress has become almost completely unproductive. With members of Congress functioning more like independent agents, the institution no longer focused credibly on checking executive power. And so, with aid from conservative majorities on the Supreme Court, presidents reasserted claims of privilege and won immunity from prosecution. Once ridiculed, Nixon's claims of inherent presidential power became law. Today's polarized parties hollowed out Congress, ineffective ethics codes, and threat of a truly imperial presidency may look little like the 1970s, but they're long-term outgrowths of the Watergate era and evidence that perhaps Ford's claim about the Constitution was mistaken all along. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.